This episode of The Tome is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of digital game books, and Gamer's Attic, your source for physical game products that gives you a free gift with every order.
My name is Harley Stroh, and I'm the line editor for the Goodman Games Dungeon Crawl Classics, and you are about to enter the dungeon of the Vorpal Network. Snickeder Snack, roll for initiative.
Hi, I'm Steve Kenson of Green Running Publishing. You're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 104. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to cast a magic spell with arcane power. Magic. All right, well, first I wanted to introduce our guest for this episode. First up, we have a newcomer to the show, a newcomer appearing on the show, Chris Hurd from the Icosahedrophilia podcast. Because having a show that you can spell would just be too easy. Welcome to the show, man.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and you're right. Having a show name that you could spell or pronounce would be, that'd be taking the easy way out.
Luckily, your web address is not actually Icosahedrophilia, though.
No, it's not. It's d20.herdworld.com, and herd is H-E-A-R-D.
And then secondly, we also have Quinn Murphy, the Game Fiend, returning from the At Will blog, and welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
I'm here.
And we're here today to talk about arcane power, like we mentioned. This is the second in the Power Source series books from Wizards of the Coast. The first one gave us more options for martial power classes, like fighters and rogues and rangers and what have you. But this book is going to tell us all about how to use the arcane power source and give us some more options for that. Before we get into the in-depth review here, though, I wanted to mention our first sponsor, RPGNow.com. My pick for this episode is the Easy Dungeons Deluxe Edition. It is a $12 PDF that will make it easy for you to create your own three-dimensional dungeons with walls and arches and doors and secret panels and living floors and treasure hoards and all kinds of stuff. You can find that over at RPGNow.com, and don't forget to tell them that The Tome Show sent you.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Fat Dragon Games, Green Ronin Publishing, and Wizards of the Coast. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
And now, Arcane Power by Logan Bonner, Eitan Bernstein, and Peter Lee. So, first of all, we want to just introduce the book. And like I'd mentioned previously, Arcane Power is designed just to give us some more options for your arcane power source characters. Just a real quick initial thoughts on this topic. Does it do that? Does it give us a lot of options?
Oh, does it ever?
Yeah, by absolutely. The truckload. Yeah.
Now, it's worth noting that in the original Player's Handbook, you only had a handful of arcane power-sourced characters, the Wizard and the Warlock. But with the addition of the Forgotten Realms Player's Guide and Player's Handbook 2, they've also added Sword Mages, Bards, and Sorcerers to the mix.
Yeah, that's right. And those character classes are fully supported in this book, which I think is a really exciting thing, and Wizards is really delivering on their promise, you know, for 4E, that basically everything is core.
That's right. At the same time, it does leave somebody who doesn't want to buy everything wondering, okay, so I didn't buy Player's Handbook 2, I didn't buy Forgotten Realms Player's Guide, is this book is useful to me? And you have to start asking that question.
Well, sure you do, but by the same token, I mean, I don't know how many players are actually going to play every single class that's available, and yet they still might want the options that are, you know, that are printed in the books. So somebody who only plays fighters and not rangers or rogues still is going to get a lot out of martial power, and I think the same thing is true for somebody who wants to play a wizard is still going to get a lot of value out of arcane power, even if they don't ever play a bard.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, I tend to look at the power books and just all sorts of, like, player-centric books like this as really sort of catalogs, right? And just like any catalog, you're not going to buy everything in it. But sometimes it's just nice to shop around, like, you know, you don't play a warlock or a sorcerer, and you play, let's say, a wizard, but it's still cool to see what the sorcerer and the warlock do, or the sword mage, or any of those other things, even if you don't have the full view from having the other books.
Sure. And let's go ahead and give people a quick idea of what's actually in this book so they have an idea before we get into some of the more details. We're going to discuss some of the new ideas brought in with the book and on some of the new build options that it gives to each class. But first, let's take a quick break here to mention GamersAddict.com, the new sponsor for this episode. At GamersAddict.com, you can get all of the game products you love for a discounted rate. Meanwhile, you're also supporting a brick-and-mortar store at the same time, since the site is affiliated with a local, friendly game store. Support a small business, get an internet discount. You can't do better than that. The Player's Handbook Power Cards decks, for example, are $2 off right now. And what's more, use the coupon code RADIO, that's R-A-D-I-O, and get an additional $3 off any purchase of $30 or more. That's GamersAddict.com.
Gamers Addict Attack! We have dice of every stripe, any color scheme and shape you can imagine. Exclusive dice, gold-plated dice, blank dice, label dice, cheat dice, D8 ability dice, crystal dice, time dice, dice within dice dice, and jumbo foam dice for when you feel the inescapable urge to pelt your fellow players or annoying commercial announcers. And that's just a few of them! We sell enough dice to form a high-intensity plastic bridge from the Earth to the Moon. What's more, any order over $30 gets $3 off when you use the coupon code RADIO. Who wants a set?
I do.
Who else?
Me.
Anyone else?
Why are you ignoring me?
I'm not ignoring you. I'm cutting you off.
What?
You order a new set every day.
So?
Is there a 12-step program for Diceaholics? Because you, sir, have a problem.
That's really strange of you to say.
Green frosted, red speckled, violet glitter, blue translucent. You couldn't say no to these beauties if you wanted to.
I'm not an addict. I could stop collecting marbles anytime I like.
Marbles? You haven't been buying marbles this whole time. You've been buying dice.
That explains why I keep losing the marbles tournament. Those 4- and 6-sided marbles aren't really all that great for rolling.
You're not only a dice junkie, you're dumb, son. Dumb.
So can I get a set?
What'll it hurt? Sure.
Woohoo! Marbles!
Remember, folks, use the coupon code RADIO to get $3 off any order over $30 at GamersAddict.com.
Obviously, it's gonna have more options on how to build those classes in different ways, right? Your different builds for bards and sorcerers and sword mage and warlock and wizards. As well as a handful of new powers for each of those classes. So if nothing else, you're getting a lot more options for how you're going to create any given class with the arcane power source. I thought it was worth noting that with a couple of classes, you actually had some changes in the way they're building the powers. And I wonder if this is an attempt to make the arcane power source feel a little different.
What exactly do you mean, Jeff?
Well, the one example that I have is the warlocks, and they had a little sidebar in the warlock power section talking about how they felt like the player's handbook sort of encouraged people to make certain choices. If you chose Fey Pact, then you were going to choose the certain powers that gave benefits to the Fey Pact. And so as a result, you ended up with a whole bunch of warlocks that were built exactly the same. So what they did in this book is they started creating powers that if you take this power, you get a certain bonus if you have the Dark Pact. But you get a different bonus if you have the Fey Pact. So one power can give different bonuses depending on what pact you have. So now you've got more options for what to choose. And at the same time, make the power feel like it fits your specific pact really well.
Right.
Yeah, and then they also did a thing of they did a lot more in this one in the Player's Handbook 1. There they sort of did a thing where you can take a power from a different pact, but most of the time it was dependent on the pact specific writer to be any good as a power. So you often didn't do it because you're like, well, I'm not Infernal Pact, and Infernal Pact is what makes the thing worth doing. Now they sort of have a lot of things where it's worth taking if you don't have the pact, but it's just a little extra awesome if you have the specific pact that it needs, which is nice.
Yeah, I agree. And they did something similar with wizard powers as well. Where your implement suddenly matters more. If you're using the Wand of Accuracy, then different powers that you have get a different boost from using that implement.
Yeah, the wand of accuracy got a lot of good attention in this one.
They also had quite a few more additions to the wizard powers that sort of do automatic damage, or they can be set up in a way to do automatic damage, whether you hit or not, which does sort of differentiate the wizard's ability to be a controller. And I wonder if this wasn't a response to a lot of people saying that the invoker from Player's Handbook 2 sort of out-controlled the wizard in every aspect.
Maybe so, or at least I think those people will be to some degree a little bit happier with the wizard now. But then again, you think about the development cycle, and most of these powers that appear in Arcane Power were already pretty much set in stone before Player's Handbook 2 hit the streets.
Sure, yeah. I suppose I think of the designers probably having noticed the same thing as they were playing those classes.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
So you get a little more pizzazz to some of those classes, and we're gonna get more into those builds and what else you can do with them in a little bit. But it also adds some new paragon paths.
Right.
For each of the, you get a handful of new paragon paths for each of the classes. You get feats that go along with the different classes, with the different builds, and just to give more options and more things that you can do with your arcane powered character. As well as new epic destinies, which I've heard from several people that they really like some of the epic destiny options provided. And
yeah,
go ahead.
Oh no, the epic destinies were pretty cool. I guess, and maybe this has colored my whole view of the epic destinies, but for some reason I felt let down by the Archlich.
Yeah.
There, but other than that, they're pretty cool. But I was just expecting a little more awesome from the Archlich.
Well, I guess that you don't want to encourage somebody too much to become undead.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing too.
But you also get new items. Specifically, you get these tome magic items, which I find highly appropriate given the show that we're on. And we'll talk more about what that tome thing is all about in a bit. But you also get, of course, if you're going to have an arcane power book, you better add some more rituals. And then the last thing they sort of mix in there is some new backgrounds, which I found to be an interesting choice and something that I think we should take some time to discuss in some more detail in a bit. Is there anything from that list, paragon paths, feats, epic destinies, rituals, all of that, that we didn't really take much time to talk on, that you want to point out as something that stood out as really cool to you, or something that seemed unusual or not quite right to you? Anything you want to point out before we get into our more specific topics?
The feats were kind of the weirdest part. I think the powers overall were pretty excellent. By and by, lots of like great options, cool stuff that you can do. The feats, and maybe I'm just greedy. You know, possibly that they're perfectly okay, and I just wanted a little more. But I was expecting a little more oomph from the arcane feats, and there are a couple in there that are, you know, when we get into it specifically, I'll sort of point them out. There are a couple in there that were just, oh my god, what are you doing? But for most of them, I was just sort of looking through it and just going, meh. But you know, that was just sort of my main thing.
Okay.
Yeah, the feats are the part of the book that I have spent the least time with, so I won't really comment on that. But one of the things that I'll just mention here up front that I really enjoyed as a longtime D&D player was seeing a lot of old spells sort of come back in their fourth edition incarnations,
yeah,
so to speak. You get your prismatic wall and your Mordenkainen's hound and things like that, and that was just really cool to see those pop up from time to time.
Absolutely. It's good to sort of appeal to the old school gamers of us out there that like to at least see the names that we recognize.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and look at some of the new builds they gave us for the different classes. We'll just go along in alphabetical order because that's the way they're listed in the book. And let's start with the Prescient Bard.
Oh, my lord.
Who can tell me what the Prescient Bard's all about? And if I pronounced it correctly.
He definitely did.
Okay.
I think out of the builds that they have there, well, first, the Prescient Bard is sort of, you know, he obviously sings and does bardly things, but his sort of specialty, where the Valor is sort of about almost being sort of a singing warlord, and Cunning is sort of a more roguelike bard. This one's almost sort of like an oracle kind of bard. You know, he sort of uses his lore and knowledge to sort of see into the future and sort of glean, you know, and sort of gamble and manipulate fate a bit. And he's also sort of, weapon-wise, the archer bard.
Yes.
And he, I think, has just crazy powers. Just looking over there, I was just like, the Crescent Bard is really pretty cool and pretty good.
Yeah, I think any kind of precognitive ability is always a little bit dicey to encode mechanically into an RPG, mainly because the character might be able to see the future a little bit, but the DM doesn't necessarily, and the players don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Prescient Bard, the way they've done this mechanically is really cool, because it does funky things that you can explain in terms of storyline by the character having caught, you know, a glimpse of what's about to happen 5 minutes down, you know, or 5 seconds in the future. So you get these really wild things. Like my players are always, you know, sitting there idly rolling dice at the table, and a 20 comes up and they say, "Hey, can I save that for later?" Well, you know, we always used to just laugh about that. But now the Prescient Bard has a power where he literally rolls 3d20 and sets them aside. To use later. I mean, it's a very cool way of getting that precognitive ability into the game mechanically in a way that doesn't actually require the DM to have a script of what's coming next.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So any other things you want to highlight with the Prescient Bard before we move along to our next friend?
I feel like it needs to be mentioned his ability, you know, the Valor has the one where you get temporary, allies get temporary hit points when they bloody something.
Uh-huh.
Cunning gets to slide people. And the Virtual Presence, it's not at will constant like Valor and Cunning, but it's still really cool. It's basically when someone would hit an ally, you basically, once an encounter, get to give them a boost to their defense that triggered it, equal to your wisdom modifier, which can be a great sort of, like, it's like having the wizard spell shield for free.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a once per encounter thing. It almost would have been nice for them to go ahead and give it an encounter power type stat block. So, you know, you could pull out your little card of it or whatever you're using to track your powers and set that one aside after you've used it. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a very cool one. I do find it a little bit strange that the bard that can see into the future also has to be the bard that is the archer. Like that combination doesn't in my head necessarily go together. I mean, it's cool to have an archer style bard. It's cool to have a bard that can see into the future. I just don't get why they have to be the same thing. Apparently you don't either.
I don't see that either.
And I guess, I mean, you can choose you can be another type of bard and choose the ranged powers and that kind of stuff, but there definitely seem to be skewed to try to aim you in that direction.
Yeah, though I think you could picture a prescient bard sort of laying down a couple of powers early on and then wading into melee if you wanted to mix and match. I think you could do it. It's not necessarily set up that way as the most efficient thing, but I could see it happening.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and there's a good mix of powers in there that are ranged weapon or not ranged weapon. So, I mean, you could definitely mix it up. But it's definitely encouraged to, if you're going to be a ranged bard, if you're going to be an archer bard, you're probably also going to be a prescient bard.
Mm-hmm.
The next class to look at then is the Sorcerer, and we have two new builds for the Sorcerer, two new sort of bloodlines or explanations as to how that Sorcerer got their magic. One is the Storm Magic Sorcerer, and the other is the Cosmic Magic Sorcerer. Who wants to tell me about the Storm Magic?
Well, okay, you remember Halle Berry in X-Men?
Yes.
All right, there's your Storm Magic Sorcerer. I mean, the name is self-explanatory. This sorcerer plays with the weather, has lots of thunder and lightning keyword types of powers, and plays around with the winds and flies around the battlefield a good little bit.
Yeah, lots of little tweaks and things that happen to them that allow them to fly a certain number of squares, or that gives them resistance to thunder and lightning and that kind of stuff, just to protect themselves from the kinds of things they're going to be throwing around the battlefield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I really like in this edition that Wizards has done is thunder or and lightning have always been sort of the, you know, redheaded stepchildren of the elements there. You know, you got sort of your lightning bolt, and that was mostly what you got for those sort of effects. And in this one, they give the, you know, with stuff like the storm magic, a real sort of character and not only, you know, mechanical sort of benefits, but sort of its own identity as an element there.
Absolutely. And they really highlight it strongly with this new sorcerer build. And then the other one is the cosmic magic sorcerer. I almost said bard there. The cosmic magic sorcerer, and this is the sorcerer who pulls their power from the cosmos, from the stars.
Right. Now, if Peter Lee is listening, I want to make sure he hears that that I want a miniature of that Dragonborn sorcerer that's on page 27. I want to see that in Arcane Heroes 3.
Yeah, but how are they
coming out later this fall?
But how are they going to make him fly?
They can do wonders with clear plastic these days.
Man, it's a really cool picture.
Yeah, it's great. And
go ahead.
Oh yeah, and it's another one, sort of you know, sort of the cousin to the Wild Mage from Player's Handbook 2, sort of the semi-random events going on there, which is, some players might not like it. I think it's kind of cool.
I think it adds. It makes the class a little bit more complex. I mean, this is not a class that I would suggest for anybody who's new to the game, because there's a lot more to keep track of with this and with the Wild Magic Sorcerer. There's just a lot to keep track of. The Cosmic Magic, I mean, one of the sort of keynote abilities they have is that they go through these phases. You know, the phase of the sun, the phase of the moon, the phase of the stars. Let's see, is that all of them?
That's all of them.
Yeah, that's all of them. So they move through the phases, though. As you know, so you might start off as phase of the sun, and then you do something in a battle, and it moves you on to phase of the moon. And depending on what phase you're in, you get different powers or different resistances or different bonuses to things.
Right, which if you're up for the bookkeeping is very cool.
Yeah, it definitely adds a whole new element to make things interesting and to keep your character fresh. At the same time, it also makes it more difficult to strategize, because you really have to be looking down the road as to how this is going to change as you move through your tactics.
Yeah, I always looked at the I look at the Cosmic Mage even more. So the Wild Mage always felt just kind of, no matter how you're going to do it, random, and that's just sort of what you're dealing with. Where the Cosmic Mage is a lot more, the randomness is sort of more, you can influence a little more. They actually have some powers in there that you can use to sort of control what's going on in terms of roles and things like that. And I think it's sort of what I call like a skill class. It's not, you know, something that's sort of point and click, like, you know, take your barbarian, hit that thing. But it can be sort of rewarding if you're into that.
Sure.
Yes, very much.
Any other thoughts on the new sorcerer builds or any of the powers that go along with them you want to highlight?
Well, I have not really spent very much time looking at the sorcerers in Player's Handbook 2 just yet. There's a thing that happens in a lot of these sorcerer powers. I don't know if it's different from the way it's presented in PH2. But in the group that I DM for, we have a wizard who likes to lay down area effects, and he keeps toasting his own companions, his allies, with these blasts and bursts. And so one of the very cool things about some of the sorcerer powers is that depending on your magic specialty, the storm magic or cosmic magic, especially in this particular book, you can you have these burst or blast powers that target all creatures in the burst. But with the right kind of magic specialty, you can exclude the character in the origin square. So this makes your sorcerer team up really well with somebody like your Avenger or your melee combatants who run out and engage an enemy in one-on-one combat. Well, you can throw your whirlwind or whatever right down on top of your ally, and if you have the right kind of magic specialty, you put them in the eye of the storm, so to speak, and hit the squares around them, which I think is really cool and gives the sorcerer a bit of a bump as a controller.
Well, it's a really cool visual to think of as well, you know.
Absolutely.
You've got your dwarven fighter out there in the middle surrounded by enemies, and then you drop a cyclone on top of him, and he's just in the eye of it with the wind whipping around, throwing enemies to the side, and the cyclone bursts away, and he's still standing there unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
Any other thoughts? Then let's look at the Sword Mage. We have a new build for the Sword Mage, being the Ensnaring Sword Mage. The Ensnaring Sword Mage, in some ways, feels a little bit like the Sword Mage who's a little bit of Avenger to me.
I see that, yep.
Yeah, I agree.
So the way this is intended to work is that the Ensnaring Sword Mage sort of singles out somebody on the battlefield and make sure that that person doesn't get away. You know, that picks out their target, and this is the person I'm going to take care of and protect the rest of the party from. But I'm going after this guy, and the rest of you worry about somebody else.
Yeah, and he does that mechanically by doing a lot of teleporting of himself and his enemy around the battlefield.
Absolutely. So what I find to be interesting on this, though, is that does the Sword Mage lose a little bit of his defenderiness by doing this? I mean, it almost feels like this kind of Sword Mage is becoming a little bit more striker. Although they don't get the bonus damage for being a striker. But in terms of how you play it tactically, it doesn't feel as much like a defender when you're jumping across the battlefield and going after this guy one-on-one.
Well, I mean, I always felt that one of the big advantages of sort of the Sword Mage as a defender was that sort of mobility. They could sort of go over, you know, they're like, I've marked you, you know, you do what you want, but just keep in mind you're going to pay for whatever you do that doesn't include me, and I'm going to go over here and chat with these folks, and, oh, what, did you do something, you know, and sort of teleport back and go through. So I feel that, you know, and with the ensnarement, since it brings the guy over to you, it's just sort of like there are just a few different flavors of doing that there, you know, with the ensnarement, it's like you can run away from your target, engage other targets, and then bring the guy back over towards you.
Uh-huh. No, and then, yeah, I suppose that's true. You are manipulating where the enemy is. You know, you've picked out your one guy, you've marked him, and if he tries to get away from you and go after somebody else, you just sort of say, and you teleport him right back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, it's almost like he's got a little twist of controller in there, just very much focused on one particular enemy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's an interesting sort of combination of things that we've had before to create a new build for a class altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Any powers that we want to highlight for the new Sword Mage?
Mm.
And then there's, of course, and along with all of these builds, there's various Paragon paths in each chapter to not only give you more flavor, but usually also intended to give you some more specific ways to build up on these specific character builds.
Right. And among those for the Sword Mage, I think the one that caught my attention the most was the Ghost Blade, simply because the Omnipresent Assault power is, I think, just about the coolest power that any class has.
Yeah, that was really cool.
It, you know, this, for those who don't know, you, you have to do something to become phasing or insubstantial before you can pull this off. This is Ghostblade Attack 20 daily power, and there are other powers that go along with it to get that insubstantiality onto your sword mage. But essentially, you teleport to every enemy that you can see in sequence, attack each one until you get back around to your starting position, which is just pretty much the awesome.
This reminded me a lot of the old, the old school X-Men arcade game. And you play Nightcrawler and you play use a special power, yeah. And he pops all over the field and hurts everybody on the screen.
Yeah. I was just getting ready to call it the Nightcrawler special there, just like bam, 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 bam.
Absolutely.
That's exactly right.
And I have to assume that that's what they were going for when they designed it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that when I read that power, that instantly came into my head. There was no other comparison to be made. Mm-hmm. All right. Then we get into our Warlock. And they've brought back a concept from 3rd edition with the Vestige Pact. Because, mm-hmm. Of course, when you're talking Warlocks, you're not talking so much about new builds as you are just new packs, which are essentially the same thing. But it gives you a little more flavor in there with it. The Vestiges are basically these almost godlike creatures that exist or have existed. And this Warlock is making a deal with those ultra-powerful beings to get different abilities.
Right.
Yep. And then you summon it through. And if there's sort of a real-world sort of analog for... Warlock's ability somehow. I looked at this one just like I did when I saw it in Tome of Magic years ago, and thought immediately voodoo, with the whole concept of sort of like the Loa, these sort of demigods that you can sort of channel and focus in at different times and get different abilities and things like that. And I of course think that's incredibly cool. And this is probably my favorite build in the book.
Sure.
See, that's funny because I think of, you know, phoning a friend from Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
That's interesting. And I feel like they took a very different approach with the Vestiges this time than they did back when they did it for 3rd edition. Because in 3rd edition, as I recall, you picked a Vestige and that sort of guided what abilities you had and gave you certain powers and what have you. This time around... you pick your Vestige, but you add more Vestiges as you go through. You know, there are certain powers you can pick up at higher levels, and that power gives you a new Vestige. And each Vestige you have gives you a different boon that you can have access to through your Warlock curse.
Right, and we should probably point out that this is another one of those sort of skill classes that Quinn was talking about before, and one of those that requires a little bit of extra bookkeeping, because as you move through the adventuring day, and all those Vestige powers are daily powers, but as you use each of those powers, then you sort of shift into a different Vestige and into a different Pact Boon. So you've got to kind of track which Pact Boon is active for your Vestige Warlock as you go through the day.
Although I feel like this is more of a moderate skill level. You know, I feel like the Wild Magic or the Cosmic Sorcerer are going to require more bookkeeping, just because you might be changing every couple of rounds.
Yeah, and this one doesn't have sort of that randomness either, so you're not going to be rolling to find out what happens with your power. With these, you could probably make a note on a card, you know, and just flip it up and down, or you know, something like that, or make yourself a little chart and mark which boon is operating at any one point.
It mechanically, now that I'm thinking about it, it feels a little bit like the Barbarian Rage.
Yeah, yes. That was the next part I would want to bring up. Yes, Barbarian Rage is, you know, and implicit with that is that if you're going to use one of these things to get the full thing out of it, just like with the Barbarian, when you're going to pop a Rage, you pop it as early as possible. There, you have to sort of make that determination there and then pop it, and then you get the most use out of it each time. And but yeah, it's very similar.
Sure.
Yeah, although the difference being that it depends on how much you want out of the associated Pact Boon, because the powers themselves have typically a pretty short duration, as opposed to the Rage. Once you enter that Rage, you know, you're in the Rage, until the end of the encounter, whereas a lot of the effects of the vestiges tend to be more short-term, like till the end of your next turn or till the end of the target's next turn, even, except for the associated boon. So it depends on how important the boon is, you know, to you as opposed to the actual effects of the power itself.
Good. And then I think it's worth noting that when you get into the Paragon paths for this section, you're adding more paths and more options, which is kind of huge for the Warlock because, as we mentioned towards the beginning of the show, the Warlock suffered from a lack of options. You know, if you were a Fae Pact Warlock, there's one Fae Pact Warlock Paragon path for you in the Player's Handbook. This is not only giving you more. You know, if I'm a Fae Pact now, I've got another option, but it's also giving you some other Warlock based Paragon paths that don't require any of the packs.
That's right. Yeah.
And so you've essentially gone from having one option to having four or five options for your Paragon path with this book.
Right. And, you know, if you hit that Paragon tier and you're just not really quite sure what to do as a Warlock, go for the Hexer. I mean, it boosts your Warlock's curse and it's appropriate for any Warlock build.
Right. Yeah. Or, of course, I mean, if you're going a different way in terms of flavor, it's not difficult to pick up you know, one of your racial Paragon paths or what have you from a different book.
Oh, sure.
And what I find, now that I'm thinking about it, what I find interesting about some of the Paragon paths here is that, and I don't know if they learned this lesson from Martial Power or if they just went a different way with it, but I noticed in Martial Power there were some Paragon paths that had a prerequisite of, you know, fighter or ranger, you know, warlord or rogue, or, you know, whatever it was. But in this one, it seems like all of the prerequisites are very specific to whatever chapter they're in. You know, if you're looking for a Warlock Paragon path, it's in the Warlock section. You're not going to find one snuck in somewhere else.
Yeah, I wonder if that's an intentional design thing, if that's because they're conceiving that, you know, I mean, martial abilities are martial abilities. I mean, there's a lot of bleed through between what a fighter does and what a ranger does. Whereas the idea behind where you get these arcane powers is very different for each of these classes.
Sure. And I could see some areas where some overlap would make sense. You know, I could see some overlap between sorcerer and warlock making sense, as well as wizard to some degree. But it does make it awfully difficult for me as a player. You know, on one hand, I like those concepts because it gives me all kinds of crazy, goofy options I can do. On the other hand, it also drives me nuts for organization because I don't know where to look to find things for my fighter or for my wizard or whatever.
Right. So one of those Paragon paths is sitting over in the rogue chapter and you don't see it in the ranger chapter.
Right. Unless, of course, you're using the character builder.
Right.
Which
everyone should be doing.
It is fantastic. So let's look at the wizard. You kind of have two new builds, but they're not really new builds.
In keeping with sort of how they do wizards now, wizards are more than any other class in the game about versatility. So it's like, you know, building an illusionist is similar to building another one. It's just which spells you're choosing.
Yes. Which is ironic because that's how wizards have always been. Wizards have always been sort of the Swiss Army knife of the game. I find them to be less so in 4th edition, but they do still have a lot of versatility in terms of how you build them, like you mentioned. So what you essentially get is you get new powers, new implements to complement what are sort of natural builds. They're not actual builds. You don't get any special abilities for being an illusionist wizard or a summoner wizard, which is what I've called these two new ideas. But you do have rules now for summoning creatures, and you do have rules and powers for illusionists. And you got new implements to sort of complement that.
Yeah, the implements are, I think, the sort of real builds that you get here, because those are the ones that give you the different mechanical effects, getting the new orb option, which enhances the illusion spells, the orb of deception, and then the tomes of binding and readiness. sort of which go for summoners, but could be really used for anything.
Well, the Tome of Binding is definitely geared towards summoners. The Tome of Readiness, I think, was they just wanted to give the a tome that wasn't a specialist. Mm-hmm. You know, because I feel like anybody can use the Tome of Readiness to great effect.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And just so people understand, somebody tell us, what does the Tome of Readiness do? Because, I mean, we know the Orb of Deception helps with illusions. We know the Tome of Binding helps with summonings. What does the Tome of Readiness do?
Go on.
Go ahead, Quint. No, you go ahead.
Basically, it lets you take a spell that you don't already know, an encounter power of your level or lower, and then you get to sort of store it away, and then at any point you can swap it from a level of the same power that you actually know already, so it just sort of gives you like an extra sort of floating encounter slot, and then you can sort of change what that is from level to level.
It's almost a little bit like burning a cleric spell to get automatic healing as a cleric in third edition.
Mm-hmm.
Only now you get to choose what it is, and you can only do it once.
Yeah.
Right.
Good. Anything else on wizards before we go on to their new best friends?
Their new best friends being the familiars?
That's what I had in mind.
No, not much for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you want to talk about the magic tomes at this point or come back to that? I don't know.
These
tomes are very interesting to me. It's an iconic thing, you know, the wizard walking around with his large book in his hands, casting spells and so on. I find the tomes a little bit awkward in a sense. I hate to, you know, say anything negative about a tome on the Tome Show, of course. But, you know, when you go back to the end, and arcane power, unlike martial power, includes a few pages of magic items, specifically magic tomes, just so that those are represented, you know, in the game. And that people who choose that aren't really disadvantaged by not having a selection of magical tomes. But those magical tomes often are storing maybe, you know, one or two powers. So I think there's a little bit of I've got a little bit of confusion, at least, sort of visualizing the relationship between a tome wizard's tome and his spell book, which are different things. I'm trying to find ways of sort of explaining this to myself and thinking about these tomes as sort of being, I don't know, almost like magic batteries in a sense. And not just a source of knowledge, but a source of, of magical energies and power that you can store different spells in. And that's not the same as copying spells into your spell book. So I'm still feeling my way a little bit with the tomes and exactly how they work. Although, you know, it's really cool to have those miniatures out there like the Tome Bound Arcanist and so forth, and have them actually using those tomes to do stuff.
Yeah, and I think the way in my head I picture a tome, like magic item being used, is I sort of see. I mean, you mentioned that the implement tome and the spell book are different things. In my head, if I'm visualizing that wizard, it's not different things. They're the same thing. You know, I'm just going to assume that they have their spells in that magic item and let it double up.
Yeah, I think as a DM, I'd certainly be comfortable with that. Although, you know, I would just mention that's not really what's described in the raw.
Right.
I mean, for me, I look at the tomes as sort of, you have your sort of spell book, which is sort of the body of your personal knowledge, and this is just how I was sort of visualizing when I thought. And then a tome is almost sort of like a reference book. Like, I'm a tech guy, so, you know, there's like a lot of stuff that I just know, skills that I've picked up over the years. But then it's, you know, what the heck is that, you know, Unix one-liner that I need to do? And I pull out my reference book, you know, and that gives me sort of the specific answers there. So if you take something, say, like the Timeless Tome, which is amazing, and basically lets you manipulate time. Like, you might know Time Stop already, which is the specific thing that it enhances. But this is sort of like, you know, some other treatise on to really let you fine tune your time manipulation. Mm-hmm. And then you sort of call that up on the fly. You've already sort of sharpen up your knowledge at the beginning of the day, and then the tome gives you some sort of on the fly, you know, some again, to sort of speak tech for a second, like some good like Unix one-liners for stopping time. And if somebody actually finds one of those, please send it my way. That would be fantastic.
I didn't realize. I mean, I didn't. I've used a lot of different computers. I never realized that Unix could stop time. That's amazing. Well, good. So yeah, there's different ways and I like both of those concepts in terms of how to handle tomes stylistically in the game. We also brought in an old chestnut from Wizards of Yore with familiars. Mm-hmm. And we finally have the familiar back, and they've finally figured out a mechanic. And it feels to me like the new version of familiars sort of really reinforces the old stereotype of familiars. That, you know, they're only around when the wizard wants to do something with them. You know, even though the familiar is sitting in the same square and the wizard was hit by a fireball, the familiar is always unscathed. It really plays that way, because now familiars are not an actual animal so much as sort of a companion spirit, and you can actually put it in your pocket and it is safe from everything, and if it dies it can pop back into existence.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you've got to make, when you have these animals hanging around, either as familiars or animal companions or pets or whatever, you got to make certain kinds of design decisions. And it's pretty clear, you know, now that with the animal companions in Martial Power or Beast Companions and the familiars here in Arcane Power, that the designers really are trying to avoid having those animals or those associated creatures be kind of a second character, but in some ways a very, very weak sort of character. So yeah, you still do get that comical kind of thing. Oh, don't you have a familiar? Oh yeah, there's been a bat following us this whole time. But I guess I would tend to favor erring in this direction, you know, tuck that mouse in your pocket and forget about it for a while or whatever. And they give you some advice on different ways that you could conceive of that, you know, maybe that your serpent familiar is not a snake hanging around your neck, but it's like a tattoo that, you know, comes to life when you need it or when you want it to, things like that.
Yeah. And they've got others that are like the book imp or the bound demon and what have you. And you could very easily explain that it's not usually around unless I summon it because I need its help.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. My favorite part on the familiar thing is probably the role playing your familiar there, otherwise known as the stop talking kind of rule.
Yeah.
Your familiar will not dominate the play session rule.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
right.
I almost feel they should have, like, you know, formatted it like in an encounter power or something like that. I thought it was a nifty choice, a little bit of sort of, you know, and they were polite. They weren't like, you know, please shut up about your familiar. But they essentially said that, and it was sort of good to take note of that your familiar can't be talking to everyone all the time.
Right.
I think they specifically sort of bound gag it so only you can hear it, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. And you do get a good mix of different familiar options. Like, you know, I mentioned the imp and the demon, and you mentioned the serpent, but you've also got bats and dragonlings and homunculuses and rats and that kind of stuff. It's also worth noting that on a recent Dragon Magazine article on D&D Insider, they give you even more familiars. And they give you some familiars there which you can only take at Paragon or Epic Tiers. Which I thought was an interesting concept that isn't in this book, but it is on that article.
Right.
And it kind of makes sense because you want your familiar to be able to scale up in power along with the character in order to keep them useful.
Sure.
But then depending on which familiar you choose, there's different little benefits you get for having that familiar around, which has always been the standard trope for familiars.
And I think it's worth noticing, yeah, that I like the sort of flipping between that passive active kind of thing. Like, I'm going to send it out. it's going to do stuff, but now it's vulnerable. And then, or it's just sitting there and it's just giving me like a sort of static bonus, but it can't be hurt. And then along with it, what I call the sort of, no more tears options there, that the familiars are really more spirits and sort of magical than they are actual creatures. So there's no, you know, your pet weasel actually isn't going to like die forever. You know, if it gets hit, it goes away until you sort of take a short rest and sort of resummon it out, and then we'll come back, probably curse at you for letting it get hurt in the first place. Mm-hmm. But then it'll be ready to go, so you can sort of keep it around. But if you get sort of too crazy with it, it will go away for a time.
Sure. Although it does also eliminate a concept that's always existed in my head of the wizard dies and the familiar sticks around. Because mechanically, that's not what mm-hmm. happens now. The wizard dies, and so does the familiar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's familiars. I also thought it was interesting that they included backgrounds in here. And it seems to me that more and more and more the folks over at Wizards are playing with this concept of backgrounds. They first introduced backgrounds when they released the Forgotten Realms books to help your Forgotten Realms characters feel more like they're from a specific region. but they continued it on with the Scales of War adventure path. They continued it on again. What was the last book that had it? Was it Player's Handbook 2?
Yes.
Had a whole set of them. And now you've got another, what is it, five or six?
Five.
You got five new little backgrounds that you can use with your arcane character, specifically focused on an arcane character. Do we like this, or is this getting more and more convoluted the more backgrounds they add?
I like it. Definitely. I think it's a great way to sort of say, okay, here's a, especially because one of the problems I find in 4th Ed sometimes now is you get into a problem of, with the skills of say like, okay, I do use history there, but what exactly do I know with history? And using a background, you can go, well, you know, I have, you know, a history skill, but because I'm, you know, from this background, here's my specialty, here's what I really know, and here's just something I might have picked up along the way. And it gives a way to sort of differentiate and cover those things without making a whole, you know, again, without sort of adding 20 extra skills there. You just go, okay, this is my province, this is sort of things that I can call on from my background, and then it gets out of the way.
Yeah, although I think in this particular case, the execution may not be quite as satisfying as it is in the Forgotten Realms, for example.
Yeah.
Because these are pretty generic types of backgrounds, and the benefits are really just a +2 to a skill check or getting to, you know, train in a skill that you might not otherwise get to train in. And so, I don't know. I don't feel like these particular backgrounds in Arcane Power contribute to sort of role playing and flavorizing your character as much as they do in the Forgotten Realms context.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know how familiar you are with the Scales of War Adventure Path backgrounds that they released, but they have a very similar feel to me that the Forgotten Realms ones have. And really add something to who that character is. These are very generic. I mean, it's just this is your background path. There's a little paragraph about what that means, and here's a couple of skills that are associated with that. You get some benefits to those skills. The end.
Yeah.
You
know? There's
a lot less of that sort of tweaking with the you get a bonus in this skill, but you also get a language, or you get this bonus. Benefit to your hit points because you're from the land of wizards or whatever it is.
Right. And of course, it's much harder to do that sort of flavorful stuff in a generic core rule book than it is in a setting specific book.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, let's get into our conclusion then. Any last thoughts that we want to add to our discussion on Arcane Power?
I feel that I would do people a great disservice if I didn't call out just a couple of things that I noticed for the wizard, which I just thought were just crazy cool.
Make first, it so?
Greece. Greece is awesome. I love Greece. Like Greece has always been like a great sort of, you know, I feel like unsung wizard spell.
So you're
there.
So you're a John Travolta fan?
Olivia Newton-John.
Exactly. Exactly. you know, cue your musical, right? But it, you know, it's always been like this great spell, and it's just so good in this. You know, just basic effect. You know, it makes a first, it's a big spell. It's like a burst two, and then when something walks into it, you get to make an attack versus, you know, reflex on it. And if you hit, you knock it prone. But if you miss, you slide it two squares. And it's just a great control daily, I think.
Yep, absolutely.
That's cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I really want to just sort of pimp the Bard rituals for a minute. There's a couple of rituals, especially for Bards. The Call of Friendship at 4th level and the Anthem of Unity at 8th level. Both of these basically, it takes 10 minutes. This is not a combat, not a thing you do in combat, but when you're dealing with villagers or you're dealing with communities and you've got a bard in the party, it's really great to be able to have that bard do some cool ritually diplomacy things and sway some people to your cause, depending on their skill check, possibly even against their better judgment or, you know, their own best interests, in order to help you and the party.
Yeah, the bard and the bard's rituals, both in this book and in Player's Handbook 2, really add a lot of mechanics to interact with role-playing situations.
Yep.
More so than in any other class. Mm-hmm. All right, well, this book is listed as at about $30 cover price. Mm-hmm. To whom is this book worth $30?
It's worth $30 to addicts like myself who just buy everything anyways. If you're playing someone, you know, you're thinking about playing Arcane, I mean, I would really rank it up there. When I first saw it, my first impression of it that I put on the site a few weeks ago, I was sort of meh on it, but as I've gone back over and over it, just looking at stuff, it's really pretty awesome. It doesn't leap out to you as cool as immediately as Martial Power, but it is really quite good.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are some players out there who always play Arcane characters. You know, we have one guy in our group who has played nothing but Arcane characters since we started playing together a few years ago. You know, so I think players like that probably, you know, will get a lot of value out of this over the course of, I mean, come on, if you use this weekly for a year, that's less than 50 cents a week, right?
Right.
And of course, if somebody should go to the Tomes Amazon store or to Icosahedrophilia's Amazon store, they're not going to pay $30 for it.
No, in fact, right now, as we're recording, it's $19.07. That is, of course, if you don't have a local game store you want to be supporting.
Correct.
So let's summarize real quick. We mentioned that there's lots of new things in Arcane Power that give you new options for how to build your arcane classed characters. Bards, sorcerers, sword mage, warlocks, and wizards. All kinds of new things you can do. They make the bards able to see the future. Sorcerers can now wield the power cosmic.
And the power of the storm.
And the power of the storm, I suppose. If we want to... Wow, that's a very Marvel Comics theme, didn't it?
It is.
In any case, the sword mage can now single out one enemy and make sure they stay away from everybody else. The warlock can make a deal with various powerful vestiges. And the wizard can become an illusionist and a summoner, as well as gaining new familiars. Based off of what we said, is that we've heard a lot of positive things about the book. I haven't heard much in terms of negative things about it. We seem to like a lot of what's in here.
Yeah, you know, as I read through it, there was nothing that, you know, really struck me as poorly designed. If anything, you know, if there's there may be a little bit of power creep, and I'm sorry, I have to say there are a few typesetting issues that I think should have been caught at some point in proofreading. But you know, the content of this book is really, really good.
Yeah, and there's certain powers that really stand out. I know Quinn also during our discussion mentioned that he really liked things like Grease. We mentioned that we really like the, was it the Ghost Blade?
Mm-hmm.
That gets to yes. That gets to, wow, another Marvel reference, that gets to pop all over the screen like Nightcrawler from the old X-Men arcade game and hit everybody on the battlefield.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And for the nostalgia value, I once again just want to mention so many of the old spells that come back. Grease is one of those, Phantasmal Terrain, Mordenkainen's Faithful Hound, although renamed. Ivar's Black Tentacles is in there, although it's renamed. Things like that.
And then the Globe of Invulnerability.
Globe of Invulnerability, that's right.
Yeah, it's not so invulnerable, but it's still pretty cool.
Right. And the Prismatic Wall, which is not quite so prismatic, but it's still pretty cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, well, you got anything else to summarize there, Quinn?
Oh, yeah, no, Chris was speaking a little bit ago, just sort of mechanically, sort of everything is sound. The only thing that I saw there that I was sort of a little scratch my head at was the Paragon feat, the Orb of Imposition. I'm sort of fond of that one because basically when your target fails a save, it takes extra damage. Like, I think it's like equal to your intelligence or wisdom or something like that, which considering what it's linked to is pretty awful. Like, it's very easy for Orb Wizard to like completely lock out a monster saves mm-hmm. there. And then it's just going to take more damage doing what it's already very good at. Could get really, you know, and Orb Wizards are solo killers already. And this is just sort of like helping them like do it even faster. It seems sort of a little run away with it for me. But I think sort of one thing out of a 150 page book is pretty awesome.
Yeah. And if as a DM you find that that's really too much, you can always reduce that, you know, to 2 plus wisdom modifier or something.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we generally seem to like arcane power, even if we're a little concerned at some possible power creep going on, some of which I think can also be explained as it's just more complex than mm-hmm. what you saw in the Player's Handbook.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
But in general, if you're playing an arcane-based character, we like this book. And this has been episode 104. I want to take the time to thank our sponsors, RPGNow.com and GamersAddict.com, our new sponsor in this episode. I also wanted to thank our guests in this episode, Chris and Will. Chris, where can people find you at?
That's at d20.herdworld.com. Herdworld is spelled H-E-A-R-D world.com.
And D20 is the letter D and the number
20. The letter D and the numbers 20. That's right.
There you go. And you can find his podcast over there as well as his blog. The podcast is the Icosahedrophilia podcast.
Right. And you can find that in iTunes just by searching ICOS. You don't have to spell out the whole word.
Very good. And of course, it'll be linked in the show notes, and people should be checking it out. It is, in my opinion, one of the best, if not the best, actual play podcast out there. And if you want to hear how some of these things that we talk about in 4th edition D&D work, this is a great place to hear it.
Thank you. That's very kind.
And Will, once again, tell people where they can find your stuff.
Oh, Quinn?
Yes. Sorry, Quinn.
My stuff is over at Will, and that's @-will.omnivangelist.net. Hopefully it'll be in the show notes because it's a bit long to spell.
Yes.
And then also link to there, you can access the 4th edition forums we have there, 4Utopia there. It's small but growing. little community just for Fed, and really sort of cool positive talk going on.
Very good. And of course, you can email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums if they ever get put back up after our recent hacking. But don't forget to tell folks about the show and spread the word of why we love podcasts and keep the medium growing. Don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on this show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. And once again, you can find all of this at thetomeshow.com. This has been episode 4, Arcane Power of
The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome, The Tome.
I'm on the wall.